This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In Libya today, authorities arrested the father of the suspected Manchester Arena bomber, Salman Abedi. Libyan counterterrorism police detained Ramadan Abedi after he gave an interview denying his son's involvement in the attack. Abedi's brother, Hashem, was also arrested yesterday in Tripoli on suspicion of having links to the so-called Islamic State. Another brother was arrested in Manchester yesterday. Here's Greater Manchester Police Chief Constable Ian Hopkins.
I think it's very clear that this is a network that we are investigating. And as I've said, it continues at a pace. There's extensive investigations going on and activity taking place across Greater Manchester as we speak.
Meanwhile, nearly 1,000 soldiers are being deployed on Britain's streets to support police in the wake of the attack. And yesterday, Prime Minister Theresa May raised the threat level to critical.
This means that their assessment is not only that an attack remains highly likely, but that a further attack may be imminent.
All of which seems to affirm what our next guest says, that terrorists usually succeed in achieving two vital goals, spreading fear and provoking reactive policies. And she says attacks on soft targets are likely to get worse before things get better. Jessica Stern is a professor at the Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University. She's also co-author of ISIS, The State of Terror, and she joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So first of all, Jessica, let me just get your response or your thoughts on the arrest of the father and two brothers of the suspected bomber, Manchester bomber. Family members being so quickly arrested, what do you think?
Well, I will be honest and say that my first reaction is real horror and disgust. The idea that a whole family would be involved in killing children is disgusting and depressing and saddening. I think it's become more and more clear that there had to have been a network involved. The bomb that we now can see parts of is actually more sophisticated than one would expect a 22-year-old to be capable of producing.
Mm. I mean, there's a lot that's been developing over the past 24 hours. It's interesting because there's reports that members of the Muslim community, they told the BBC that that members of the community had actually called UK anti-terrorism hotlines warning about Abedi's potential extremist views a couple of years ago. And we also see reports now, NBC News reported that multiple U.S. intelligence and law enforcement officials say that the bomber was known to U.S. authorities before the attack. I mean, what's going on here? How is it? I know we're looking at this retrospectively, but if these two things were true and that's the case, how did authorities miss this family or this guy?
You know, I think being outside government, it's very hard to know what actually happened. I know that there are many persons of interest or people that are being watched in the United Kingdom, and maybe they're just too many. I don't know the answer. I mean, yes, it's tempting to say how stupid, but we don't really know yet.
Yeah. But so given what you know about ISIS and how it operates, what is it that counterterrorism officials, what is it that law enforcement and intelligence agencies ought to be doing? Because it seems, or ought to be doing more of, because it seems, you know, in this case, we've got potentially a whole family that's got direct connections, allegedly, to ISIS, you know, members of whom went back to Libya just very recently.
Yes, and a lot of people would go back to Libya and they would be visiting their grandparents. And it's always a trade-off how much we want to spy on people, how much we want to curtail their civil liberties. Do we want to put chips in them? You know, this is always a problem for law enforcement authorities. If they do too much, they get in trouble. If they do too little, then this kind of thing can happen. Mm. So that's the issue.
Okay. So you wrote an op-ed in the Boston Globe today about the fact that you believe that the problem of attacks on soft targets, like we saw in Manchester, is likely to get worse before it gets better. Why is that?
Well, as ISIS gets pushed out of the territory it controls, we know that some of the 4,500 or so Western foreign fighters are likely to return to their home countries and to try to carry out attacks at home. So that's one reason. The other is that in Europe, it has been possible to radicalize youth. And about 60% of those that have been radicalized to become jihadis or pro-jihadi, actually to become jihadis, are ordinary criminals. So it doesn't seem that they hold sacred values very strongly. They are ordinary criminals, and only at the 11th hour do they become jihadis.
Okay, so what draws them to go to Syria, Libya, where, what have you, and join ISIS then, if it's not necessarily some sort of deep spiritual complaint?
You know, I can tell you what scholars are looking at. I mean, nobody's been able to prove any of these risk factors, but some of them are alienation, facing prejudice, the notion that a person goes from zero to hero when he becomes a jihadi, that somebody who is not doing very well in life can put on a branding device for attacking society, somebody very angry at society, who finds it more appealing to attack in the name of some ideology. Some people actually do to hold that ideology. We find that confused identity is often a risk factor, and we see that with second generation youth. That is that does seem to be a risk factor. And interestingly, another risk factor we found in a study at Children's Hospital is time online. For kids that are already susceptible to being recruited, time online could be an indicator.
Right. Well, I want to get back to something that you wrote again in your op-ed today in The Globe, that you wrote that terrorism is psychological warfare. The principal goal is to frighten us into overreacting. You know, I'm just thinking about the fact that, you know, British Prime Minister Theresa May probably has the best reasons to deploy all those troops, for example, right now on the streets of Great Britain. About 1,000 are there, and I'm reading that, you know, potentially another 3,800 could be deployed to support law enforcement and police. But, I mean, does that signal just the deployment of military on the streets of Great Britain signal some kind of propaganda victory for ISIS in this attack?
We could say that. I mean, almost every counterterrorism measure we take, in some ways, we could describe as a victory for the terrorists. My understanding is that, at least for now, those military personnel are there because the police have to work too many hours. It's not that it's not a civil war, obviously. It's just to relieve some police personnel who are having to work too hard.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, like, they're just in the immediate aftermath, 48 hours later from a terrible attack, and there's a great deal of work to be done. But I'm, you know, I was thinking about what you wrote today, and in the scheme of the optics, or the way that something like seeing uniformed military on the streets of, you know, the democracy of the United Kingdom comes across. Like, on the one hand, maybe it gives a sense of comfort to people in the UK right now, but on the other hand, it's a shift in their lives, even if it's temporary. And one can only imagine how those visuals are being used by ISIS itself in terms of, look what we got the UK to do. Do you see what I'm saying? Because it's the psychological warfare part that you write about.
Of course. I mean, I imagine many people do feel better seeing those personnel, and some people probably feel worse. But there are a lot more worrisome reactions, I think, in the immediate aftermath of a terrorist strike that one could contemplate it. I think using military personnel to relieve police doesn't seem so terrible to me.
Well, what about this greater issue of how people react to the thought of a terrorist attack, or the possibility of a terrorist attack? Because, I mean, you quote some pretty astounding numbers here, that 70% of Americans, 83% of Republicans and 65% of Democrats say that terrorism is a critical issue to them personally, and that potentially, I mean, when you look at the strict numbers, may be an outsized fear.
I think it actually is an outsized fear. You know, when we think about what are the risks that Americans face, the risks from gun violence are massively higher than the risk from terrorist violence, about 1,000 to 1. In fact, more than 1,000 to 1. And yet somehow we imagine ourselves to be in control of our munitions. I mean, the psychometric model of how we respond to risk shows that when we have the illusion of control, we feel much more at ease about exposure to danger. So we think that when we're behind the wheel of a car, that we're safer than when often people feel safer in driving their own car than flying, having somebody fly them in a plane, in a big plane. And in fact, it's much safer to fly than to drive. Mm. Driving is one of the more dangerous things we do. Swimming, riding a bike, those are relatively dangerous things. And yet because we have the sense we're in control and there isn't a random impact, we feel much safer.
Right. Right. I mean, isn't that the thing? Isn't that why terrorism causes such a particular kind of dread?
Yes.
Right? Because,
yes.
I mean, in the case of car crashes or gun violence, I mean, a lot of gun violence is deliberate, but a lot of it is not. But whereas a terrorist attack is seen as it's a deliberate attack in places that are supposed to be, ostensibly, we believe, are safe. I mean, this was a concert that kids and teens were going to.
Right. Yeah, I think there are two aspects to it. One is that it's random, that anybody could be affected by it. And that comes out of the psychometric model. But what I propose to add to that is the notion of evil. I think that knowing that a human being is deliberately targeting children just chills us. And I think that's just human nature, that really makes us frightened, makes us feel terrible dread. Even though if we look at the data, the risks are really very small. I mean, the number of terrorist attacks that occur in the West in comparison with war zones, in places where there are fragile governments, massively more terrorism occurs in those countries. Also, if we compare this terrorism campaign with earlier campaigns in Europe, this is very small in comparison. If we compare the number of people who died in the concert attack with the 9/11 strikes, again, it's a relatively small number. It's a horrifying attack. Mm-hmm. But it is important to balance looking at the data and the actual feelings we have.
I mean, I get that. I get that. Again, the matter of sort of absolute numbers and what the data tell us. But I mean, you yourself talk about this, again, the spiritual dread. And I think that's also important to just acknowledge that there is so much uncertainty with these kinds of attacks. I mean, a backpack bomb is different than flying an airliner
That's right.
into a building. Terrible both, but we're living in an age where the backpack bomb seems like it could be a more likely means of attacking, right?
Yes, I actually think, ironically, that these relatively low-level attacks that occur at soft
could
targets
could be more frightening.
I think they are more frightening. I think the idea that someone could just drive up on the sidewalk or knife children, that is incredibly scary.
So let me ask you one last question, because you write a couple very interesting things in the Globe today. You write, quote, "We should question whether the current policy to demolish and destroy ISIS, to drive it out of the territory it currently controls, could have the unintended effect of spreading the organization still further around the globe, as suggested by an unnamed Israeli military official recently, and that the true response to terrorism," you write later, "requires a politically and psychologically informed response." So what is the right response here now?
I think there are two audiences that we need to be concerned about. One is you and me, moms, families. The other is people who work in the government who are charged with keeping us safe. And for them, this is a threat. They really need to pay attention to this danger because their actions will impact how risky it is for ordinary Americans to just go about their daily lives. And I do think that there is this impulse to try to destroy ISIS in the territory it controls. Our president keeps saying that.
I mean, should they not be doing that? Should we not be trying to eradicate ISIS in the Middle East and in Iraq?
We're not going to eradicate ISIS. That's not going to happen. What we're trying to do is destroy them in the territory they control. But they're already spreading. And there's the danger they will spread further into Jordan, into Lebanon. That right now they are. Shiite militias are fighting them. They are fighting, especially in Syria, many other terrorist organizations. We think that the most important enemy to terrorist organizations is the government fighting them, but often their worst enemy are the other terrorist organizations with whom they're competing for money, personnel, attention. Mm-hmm. And yet the impulse to destroy them there could have the, obviously unintended but perverse effect of spreading the organization further.
So, I mean, what are the other options then? Containment? Going after them in the way that we went after Al-Qaeda, for example, sort of a decapitation of the organization and then hopefully a collapse? I mean, what are the other options if not stamping ISIS out?
You know, I think that this is a crisis in Muslim-majority countries, especially Iraq and Syria. Obviously, it's a sectarian crisis. It's a crisis within Sunni Islam. I think that King Abdullah of Jordan has it right when he says that the West can only help at the margins. The West cannot solve this problem. The issue for us is that it's not our fault, but we did play a role in the creation of these jihadi groups when we elected to go to war in Iraq. We created, essentially, Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That was formed in response to our invasion. And many of these groups, ISIS, Nusra, come out of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So when the Iraqi military asks us, please help us, we are, I believe, obligated to help. But we also need to consider that until we have a solution to the disenfranchisement of Sunni Muslims in both Iraq and Syria, until we have an idea about what to do about Syria, destroying this particular terrorist organization with this particular name is not going to solve the problem.
Well, Jessica Stern is a professor at the Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University. She's also co-author of ISIS, The State of Terror. We'll have a link to her op-ed, which appeared in the Boston Globe today, at radioboston.org. Jessica Stern, thank you so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.